This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Dug Too Deep, the officially unofficial podcast for The Rings of Power on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking feedback for Season 1, Episode 8. It's the season finale. Aaron, I'm going to go ahead and guess that we got double the amount of feedback on this finale.
We did. The poison pill is that so many of people's takes were completely superseded by the action of Episode 8, which was, I think,
okay,
far more revealing than people were expecting it. Because, like, I was, like, hoping for some clarity on the Stranger and who Sauron was, and maybe the ring. We essentially got massive clarity on Sauron, massive clarity on the Stranger, although I do think they're being a little sneaky there, too. And we got the forging of the rings. So, like,
yeah.
You know, a lot of people speculating this stuff being pushed off to season two or going a different way. Just, got hit by a pyroclastic cloud of episode 8.
Yeah. It feels like I'm not questioning, like, what are the mysteries that, we've been left with this season? It's more like, what now?
Yes.
We've forged the rings. Mount Doom is created. Sauron's going there. And we have a wizard on the loose. What now?
Yeah. And I think that's a good place for the show to be in. I think it's positive that I was expecting it to continue to drag its feet on these mysteries. And the fact that largely they seem to not be wanting to keep that going is, I think, a huge plus. But we did get a lot of feedback. So let's get right to it. DugTooDeep@baldmove.com is where you want to send feedback. This is relevant because we will have a final wrap up podcast where we're going to talk about, all of our feelings, where it's going, consider some more feedback, et cetera, just to kind of set us on course. And also, I'm going to try to do some digging because I don't know when we're expecting the show to come back.
Yeah.
I suspect because of its ambition and scale and the amount of post-processing it requires, we're not going to see it until 2024. But I don't know, maybe they've got some kind of assembly line, Peter Jackson style, continually filming. We knew we were going to do, maybe this season two is well underway. I don't have a sense of that. So that's certainly something I'm going to want to talk about. First up is Dante. I agree with most of your critiques, though not as vehemently. I'm still enjoying the show and I'm going to watch it in upcoming seasons. I do have some thoughts, though. I don't think the insinuation is really that Celeborn, which you'll recall is Galadriel's husband, is dead. I don't think he'll be coming back from heaven or anything like that. She mentions that he left for war at the end of the Second Age, but then so did she. She never saw him again because of the darkness. Revenge took over her, and she never returned home. She abandoned him. She's slow to talk about it because of the shame and guilt weigh heavily on everyone's shoulders in this episode. She lost him to the war because she lost herself. I think that's interesting and her starting point to understand and realize the error of her ways. Having a loving reunion with her husband may help bring her back to the light. Not to make her stop being a soldier, but to help her resist and come off that ledge of darkness. And I'm into that. Jim, a lot of people had this kind of similar take that, like, why are you guys getting so upset about Celeborn being dead or Celeborn not being established or whatever. He could just be missing. He could be a prisoner of war. He could. And I think these are valid points, but it doesn't really change my mind on how they handle it. How about you?
It's impossible for me to get mad about it because I don't have a dog in that fight, right? Like, I don't think I got mad about Celeborn not being alive or whatever. I think this is a very good possibility here that she is feeling guilty about what she did. She doesn't mourn for the husband she lost. She's more like, I went off on this damn fool idealistic crusade, and because of it, I haven't seen my husband in a very long time. That makes a lot more sense than, I guess, based on what I understand from the lore, that he is actually like dead or in Balinor or something like that. So,
yeah, to me, I don't give a shit about the lore, and I apologize if I gave that. You know, I was saying that, like, I think some lore purists will be upset by it, but like, I don't care. I think that it was handled clunky, that there was, I think it would have been better if they'd established the fact that she had a husband that she considered lost during the war, instead of the single-minded focus on Finrod. And then when she's trying to, you know, bond with this teenager, and he asks her if you've lost anyone, she says her brother right away. We're expecting that. And then she trails off and hesitates and says, also my husband. I just think that's a clunky way to introduce that subplot. You know, there could have been other where, you know, and like, well, she's not talking about it because she's embarrassed or ashamed. And like, I don't think that's indicative of her interior mind. I don't think that she's embarrassed or ashamed about her single-minded devotion to this destruction. I think she thinks she's self-righteous and right, even down to the latest episode. So, like, I don't know why she wouldn't be paying homage. And then, like, also, I don't think Celeborn is lost like Galadriel was lost. Like, Galadriel wasn't lost. Like, Gil-galad knew where she was and what she was doing at all times, probably was in fairly regular contact with her, right? Like, I don't think she was, like, just fucked off for 3,000 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And never came back and never sent back message to the king and never did. Like, I don't think that's what happened. Whereas this guy fucked off at the beginning of the First Age, I think, and has never been heard of since. Like, I think he's dead. He's MIA, can presume KIA, right?
I have no idea. I don't know anything about him. Yeah.
And if that's the case, then I would expect her to talk about it in a different kind of way. You know, and like everyone's saying, like, oh, he's just missing, and she never says he's dead. But I feel it's pretty clear that Galadriel thinks he's dead. That's what my I don't give a shit that Teleporno is dead or not dead. He's gonna come back to life. I don't think they did a really good job of establishing it in our minds, and it's almost like an afterthought. Like, oh fuck, we want Celeborn to come back at some point. Oh shit, we haven't even established him, and we're like 7 episodes into this thing. Ah, you know, and they did this scene. So, Aaron from San Francisco says, good news. I'm very entertained by T-Rop and look forward to each new episode. Bad news. I just can't take the show seriously anymore after the whole volcano thing. I was honestly disappointed that episode 7 didn't feature a special guest appearance by Jeff Bezos as Eru Arugula Iluvatar. I imagined him flying in on a copper penis-shaped rocket ship and stopping the volcano with a purposeful crash landing. He could emerge triumphant from the smoke and ash, spaceman helmet tucked under one arm, smiley arrow face, Amazon logo emblazoned across his flight suit, smoking crater with the back end of a rocket ship sticking out the top of the background. I sincerely hope they stick to landing in the season finale and make a great comeback for season 2, because I want to love this show. Well, they did it for us. Like, I'm back to being pretty enthusiastic about the show, but it's all going to come down to, like, what lessons have they learned?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You can't make the same mistakes in season 2 and expect me to tolerate it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one thing. It's like, this is a learning experience, probably some COVID stuff in there. You know, they had very inexperienced showrunners, which, you know, is what it is. Let's see how they do in season 2. But I'm glad they're able to get a little bit of momentum going in, because it was looking pretty grim there at the end of episode 7 for me.
I do want Jeff Bezos to show up in this show. That's my only wish for season 2, is that Jeff Bezos will show up. People don't know this, but he does have big Harfoot, hairy type feet. Like, in real life, that's just the kind of feet he has. So if they can just put him in front of the camera, shrink him down, you know, digitally, he'd fit right in.
See, I was going to go with, he looks like Gollum with a better dental plan.
Yeah. Yeah,
so he could do that thing as well. Do you think that Bezos is too good to just play an uncredited orc in the background?
Probably.
I think that'd be funny. And
look, he never went on the Expanse. He like did a personal campaign to save the Expanse, and spent a whole bunch of probably his own money to do it. And he was never on that show. So I can't see him showing up here. Sorry. Yeah. I'm disappointed. I'm just as disappointed as you are.
Let's move on to Randy from Jersey says, I'm still impressed with the production values of the Rings of Power, and there were definitely some good scenes and character interactions this episode, but I'm kind of surprised you guys didn't go a little harder on the plot contrivances inconsistencies. We're talking about episode 7, I believe. Or no, episode 6, actually. What happened to your wife? She drowned. So is the sea always right? I mean, that's a joke thing you said, but like... It's one of those things indicative where I feel like there was people building the world and like doing things like, oh, what are some things that make Numenorean culture distinct? And then there was another group of people that were writing the plot, and those people didn't necessarily always shake hands and tell each other what they're working on. Because you're right. The sea's always right. Well, if Ellen Deal's wife drowned, then... I don't know. The seer itself is rejecting her and her elf friend ways. Or maybe she was an elf fiend. I don't know. Didn't the villagers leave their village and go to the elven fortress because it was safer and more easily defended? And then the first thing to do is abandon the fortress and go back to the village. And the place to make their last stand is a tavern? Does any of this make sense militarily? There's some cool moments during that battle if you didn't think too hard about any of it. I mean, I get that the fort had the secret button that you could push that would send the tower down to kill everyone around it. And that was a really neat trick. Mm-hmm. But like, it's weird that they were saying like, oh, we got it's almost like they planned this out to fake out the audience. Like the audience was the orc army and they're like, we got to misinform them so they fall into our trap. It's weird from our perspective. We didn't know what was going on. And again, I think this is indicative of the show's reliance of let's surprise and shock people rather than do something straightforward and clear from a motivation standpoint. This is just like in very small microcosm.
Yeah, I mean, I will say the equation had changed at that point, right? Like they went up to that tower thinking they'd have the full support of the village to defend, and then half the village left to go support Sauron, or who they thought was Sauron. So now they have half the people they thought they would. The other side has that other half that left. I think they're just thinking, well, we're screwed. We need some desperate play here to maybe kill them all. And that was the tower collapse.
Well, but crucially also,
they might have known they were screwed when they got to the village.
Bronwyn is the one that says, we got to go to the tower. Arendir gets there later and is like, oh, you're here at the test. So like maybe he has got a different plan. And so
I mean, the best plan is still to stay in the tower, because like I look at that the road up to that tower, and that is highly defensible. There's like no way those orcs get up there if they don't want them to.
Yeah, I'm playing a devil's advocate, but I think that you've got it right on here, Randy, that like you have every man, woman, and child that's strong enough to pull back a bow and throw rocks, just rain down hell on those orcs on the long winding. Yeah. And then at the very last minute, you have, maybe Arendir stay to blow the tower to take out as many as why everyone else heads down the other side of the mountain to some other refuge.
The way they did it, come up there.
Yeah, the way they didn't, it's like they should have sold that tower dearly and then scapered off to somewhere else. But again, I don't know the map. I don't know the terrain. This was not terrible. Does have another point. Why didn't the giant orc that attacked Arendir have a weapon? Arendir backs up to him. He should have got his throat slit, but instead the orc just tosses him around for 5 minutes. Yeah, that's a good point. Why doesn't this orc have like an axe or a sword or a mace or something? Because it seems like if he'd have just gone over there and caved Arendir's head in, it'd be all over.
That's why he doesn't have one, because it would be all over. They don't want him to.
Okay, so here's the other thing, is like, this is a big time trope. Like, how many times have you seen the hero being thrown around by the strong man and ragdoll him for a bit, but not really? You know, this is the Predator. You know, the Predator doesn't just kill Arnold Schwarzenegger. He has to, like, really beat the hell out of him, throw him around a bunch first. Doesn't use his weapon. Like, at some point, you got to be like, okay, here are the Western civilization tropes, and they're just as powerful as, like, Eastern animation, you know, like when a boy gets a nosebleed when he's talking to a pretty girl in anime. that's stupid and dumb and it happens all the time, but it's the way they tell stories, right? So I try not to criticize things being tropey unless they come across as hacky. And I've seen very well done versions of this that I've quite enjoyed. It's so, and I even enjoyed this one, to be honest. I thought it was a pretty cool scene. Here's a corker right here. I'm still not sure how Galadriel and the Numenorean cavalry knew exactly what village to go to. As far as we know, Halbrand just told Galadriel that the Southlands were attacked by orcs. The Southland is a big place, and yet they ride exactly where they're needed at exactly the right time. How does information get to Numenor? Yeah, because, like, if you remember the episode before, they were talking to Halbrand, and it's like, where are we going? And he points to a place on the map, which I assumed was the tower, and said, well, this is obviously where the people, if I were the people, I'd fall back to this position. But Numenor was riding, like, at max speed towards this village in particular.
Oh, maybe it's on the way.
Yeah, maybe. Like,
the road to the tower also leads through the village, so they just happen
well, now
to
that
show
we know
up
that
and there's a battle going.
Halbrand is Sauron. Is there a possibility that Sauron and Adar are working together? Because
sure,
it seems like they're antagonists at this point. Because I think everything tracks out. Like Adar, Sauron says, "Did you recognize me?" And Adar says, "No, I don't." Adar says he killed Sauron. I think he thinks he did. Sauron says he was driven off by orcs. Like, all this stuff is strictly true. So I don't think they're working together, but that would also be one easy way to resolve that. You know, they're just working together. So
yeah,
that's
I mean,
why
even if they're not working together, like, Sauron knows what's going on over there, and he's going to use this as an opportunity to embed himself in the good graces of the elves and get those rings forged and all that stuff. Yeah, I think he can use this as an opportunity to build trust. You know?
Yeah. There's a lot more Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be back right after this short break.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Now,
let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep.
Giorgio says, is it possible that you are locking in on Isildur's personality too much too soon? We have a whole 5-season character arc ahead of us, after all. Maybe they plan on to build him up slowly and show character growth and truly a change into being the hero he turns out to be before the ring then corrupts him. Won't that be a more devastating turn than whenever trials and sacrifices he endures, he grows up to be an honorable and righteous man that gets taken away by Sauron's evil ring of power?
Could be. Could be that's what they're doing. They're going to have, they set themselves a pretty high bar, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I understand that if you've read the books, you understand that Isildur is this heroic figure, and that his keeping of the One Ring wasn't even as, like, nakedly evil as it's portrayed in the movies. But in the movies, which is what 99% of Tolkien fans' point of view begins and ends with, Isildur is the prototypical weak man that fails when you need them. Like, he is the object lesson of this that Elrond throws into Gandalf's face. And I feel like this show is showing that he started off as a weak man of low character that's easily swayed and you know, this kind of, you know, not a person of substance. And his endpoint is going to be that person. So, like, that's not character development.
This no, there like could be. I don't know. I mean, when you show the flaws of a character up front, you expect them to grow out of those flaws.
Yeah.
And then to, you know, subvert that. I mean, this is all tropes, right? This is all like patterns of storytelling.
Yeah.
So, like, to then subvert that at the very end, you could be going with the point that, like, even good people, even strong people can be corrupted by the influence of the ring or whatever. But I don't know, because then you look back at him and you ask the question naturally, was he ever actually a strong or good person?
Yeah.
If you start his story like this. So I don't know. Yeah.
You might be right, Giorgio, but it feels to me like they're telling a story of how this guy, you know, how this kind of selfish, weak person came to be. Not like, oh, we're going to build this paragon of virtue and then he's going to have one moment of weakness and throw it all away. But yeah, you could be right. Roberto says, I'm surprised that Adar didn't die. After all the humanization of the orcs, it feels like Adar needed to go so Sauron can make the orcs into mindless servants for his purposes again. I think Adar is one of the strongest points of the show, so maybe they need him alive. Oh, I think season two is going to deal a lot with Sauron vying with Adar for supremacy.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, they're both in the same land now. Yeah, I don't have a great read on Adar and Sauron's relationship as a thing. I don't know if they're going to be best of buds when he gets there or if they're going to be antagonistic.
I really worry that the showrunners don't know anything more than we, that they have, like, this is an interesting idea and we'll figure it out in season two. Because here's the thing, is like, Sauron's extremely powerful, but he has no army.
Sure.
And Adar is extremely powerful by rights of being an ancient elf that's been corrupted by darkness. And he has an army that he has just delivered for in a big, big way. So I wonder if Sauron can convince Adar. Does Sauron show up as Halbrand and be like, you know what? I was the king of the South. I can deliver the rest of the South to you. And like worms his way, kind of like he essentially plays in plain view of the audience the scam that he ran on Numenor and Galadriel this season. Only runs it on Adar and the orcs.
Maybe.
Like, you know, you kicked their asses. The scales have fallen from my eyes. I'm no longer going to be deceived by these men and these elves. I want the South to be ran by the Southlands. I want the oppressed humans and orcs to live together in unity. And Adar's like, hell yeah, if you can deliver me the South, then. But all he can do is deliver a village of like 35 maimed old men at this point. So yeah. I don't know. I don't know. Adam, Jesus, the show's really got to me. Adam says, I maintain Theo is likely Aaron Deere's son. Sure, there's some lore conflicts on making another half-elf, but I can't see why he's a darker skin than his mother and has pointy ears.
He has pointy ears?
I don't think he has pointy ears.
I've not seen these pointy ears, but maybe. I have not been watching this kid's ears, so.
I think he's got... And here's the other thing about dark, like, he's, come on, let's settle down. Number one, Aaron Deere's not that dark-skinned. Second, like, I'm co-hosting with a dude whose brother looks stereotypically Mediterranean, and he's super white. And my co-host here is super white. So, like, that happens. Like, we're talking minor shades of difference here. He also says Theo and Galadriel, and the other thing is, like, I just don't know where that gets us. See, I think he's saying that maybe I've heard a lot of people express the fact that this guy's ears are hidden, and you got hidden ears. You think of elves, you know, because of the Galadriel thing.
Anyway, so what are you saying? Where does that get us if Theo is a like half elf?
Yeah, what does that do for the story?
I have no idea. I mean, half elves are significant. Right,
yeah, like almost always.
In the Tolkien lore, in ways that I'm not super familiar with, but I know they're almost like, are they harbingers of? I want to say they're almost like savior type characters. Am I wrong? Are they like harbingers of unity or something, or is that?
They're always like very powerful, very impactful. They definitely have huge impacts in the plot. You know, they give birth to people who have, you know, echo throughout the plot.
Yeah, like Elrond.
But they're always also seen as star-crossed. They're tragic figures.
You know, okay.
Because Tolkien displays them as from two different worlds, and they're kind of like, you know, doomed to have a bad end because they just can't be together forever. And that kind of, you know, that tragedy kind of informs all the writing. So, I mean, maybe it's a tragic coupling, but I would
say it's risky, but like for them to introduce another half elf. But I would say also when you talk about, you know, most of people's point of view is just they've watched the Lord of the Rings movies.
Sure.
So they don't really know all that lore and stuff. And also, the people who are inclined to be angry about a decision like that are already pissed off at this show and kind of hate it. So, and they're still watching it. They're still watching it. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
They're out there every single week clicking the button to give Amazon more likes and more views and higher numbers and more money. But boy, are they vociferous about how much they dislike this show already. So you can't really piss them off too much more. So sure, I guess go for it. If you want to make him a half elf, do it, because I won't really care. I don't understand the significance enough, and I'm one of those just I watch the movies kind of guys. So I don't know. Try it, see what happens.
I just don't think that Aaron Deere nor Bronwyn act like a person who has fucked to the point that they even have a 15-year-old, 16-year-old child. They just don't.
You mean each other, right? Because Bronwyn almost certainly has.
Okay. Unless it's an immaculate conception. But yeah, Aaron Deere. No, okay, Aaron Deere is super virgin. Super virgin, straight edge,
seems like
elf.
It. Yeah.
Adam says also Theo and Galadriel are an interesting relationship as he serves as a mirror for Galadriel. His anger and shame and guilt are similar to hers. Only through guiding this young man or possibly half elf might she perhaps see the flaw in her own vengeance streak. I think we'll see these two on screen together again. Do we? How? I wonder. And to me, I think it's going to be tragic because Galadriel sent him on this path of being a soldier and being proud to fight for the Southlands. And now the Southlands has been corrupted to a bad end all around. So it's going to be another kind of failure of hers that's starting to mount and add up.
I mean, they got to move to the country and plant their Alfurion garden, right? They got to see each other again.
Oh, well, we're talking about Theo and Galadriel. We're not talking about Aaron Deere and Bronwyn here.
Gotcha.
Finally, it's really something else. They made Beric a fully realized character. He's far more qualified than Isildur and will single-hoofedly save his ass, without which we don't get Lord of the Rings. So Beric, the real MVP. Hard to disagree.
Yeah.
Hard to disagree. And he did it with a cool-ass scar, too. Another Aaron comes up, says, listening to this week's feedback podcast for Rings of Power and was twisted up about Aaron's heroine comparison with Arwen and Aragorn's relationship. I think it's a beautiful picture of someone choosing love for a short time versus never having experienced it. The question really is, if you knew You would only have 10 to 15 years of a true, blissful, and loving, fulfilling love partner, and then they would die of cancer or heart disease, and you would lose them. Is that a choice you would make? Arwen's life isn't necessarily over after Aragorn's death. She's not living under a bridge giving 50 cent blowjobs. She's that. I guess that's rock bottom. I guess that's rock bottom. If she's holding the line at a dollar, you know, she's got a shred of dignity. 50 cents.
At least you can get a Coke from the vending machine. Yeah. 50 cents. Can't do anything with that.
Can't do nothing. She's sad and lonely without the loss of her love, but I bet she would not trade the experiences she had with him for the world. I think we as humans make this choice all the time. All relationships are temporary and potentially short. It's part of life. Many of us never experienced this kind of love and would gladly give the world to have it, even if it meant it would only last a season. Love is always enriching and life-affirming. Heroin is ugly in death. Just my two cents. Love the podcast as always. The thing is, I think if you ask your average Lord of the Rings fan what they think of Arwen and Aragorn's relationship, they wouldn't say that, well, you know, of course they ended up exactly like Elrond said to Arwen, which shocked and dismayed her and made her pack up and go to the Grey Havens, right? And she got waylaid by a vision of a child. And I guess also, like, I'd have to know your opinion on the movie Arrival, because that posits a very similar kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they have two main characters that have very differing experiences. I don't think everyone at the end of an experience would say, I would trade this 3 to 6 months of misery for, you know, and I would rather have loved and lost and never loved. I don't think that's a universal experience at all. There are some things that are so traumatic that you're like, no, fuck me. If I could go back and spare myself, I would. Mm-hmm. And I just think that, like, where they leave Arwen at the end of the third age going into the fourth is really a bad spot, you know? Eugene says, I feel like you missed or failed to talk about an important development. When Durin and Deese were talking about becoming king, they took a noticeable turn towards the dark side. They got all possessive and started referring to the kingdom as mine and ours. I'm guessing it's either the effect of the evil release from Mount Doom or digging too deep. What do you guys think? I didn't get that, but there is this kind of weak association between possessive and evil, you know, like it's the hallmark of Gollum.
Yeah, yeah.
And anyone, anytime the ring bearer starts talking about mine, it's precious, it's just mine, that shows that they've been corrupted.
Yeah, I mean, greed is one of the sins, right? The typical seven deadly sins.
But also, this is a real thing, that this is a kingdom that they will possess and inherit because they are the next in line for the throne. So to me, it's like when I told my mother at 16, when I get out of this place, I'm running my house completely different way, Mom. Like, I don't think that's me evil. That's just me saying I can't fucking wait to the keys of my own life are flipped to me and I can start driving. Although how I've turned out, your mileage may vary whether you consider good or evil.
I wasn't reading evil either. Maybe they're going for that. If so, it's very subtle. And maybe they'll build on it. But yeah, that's not how I was reading it.
I did think it was a weird affect to essentially, after your friend and all of his species are condemned to death, to be like, well, but think on the bright side, when your dad dies, we'll be able to do whatever we want. It's like, oof. It's cold comfort in that moment.
Maybe they already have a plot going and he's going to die like next week. And then they can fix it all. I mean, obviously, we'll not with everything we saw in this episode, but.
John G says, one thing I've disagreed with you this season is the constant criticism and side-eyed thrown at the idea of the Harfoots leaving people behind. For me, this has been one of the good things about the show, because I'm with Jim. I don't like too much fantasy in my fantasy. I don't want prophesied heroes from good and light who are born special with the mission to fight the evil of darkness that were born bad. It's just not that interesting. However, in Tolkien, we have hobbits and Harfoots, and they don't have any magic. They're very small. It's a very dangerous world of big people and monsters. For me, that touch of realism in this fantastical world is nice. It means more to me what happens to these characters, because they live in a world where they need to make these terrible and hard decisions, like leaving people behind, because otherwise they all die. It's not always do the right thing that feels nice and you feel good about it, then you'll always be right. Their struggles make sense on a level that we understand. Not that I don't like the bigger supernatural fantasy elements being here. The finale had some great scenes of Sauron letting his power free and taking over Galadriel's mind, as well as the Swedish death metal team and all of their magic. What do you think? Because, like,
I get that sentiment, but they didn't even try. Like, I also want my characters to try to save each other. And it seems like they are eager to leave people behind is the impression I got. Like, you fall one step behind, you're dead to us. There was no immediate danger when Meteor Man's being dragged around in this caravan. If there were wolves attacking while they were on the road and they needed to leave them behind, yes, totally. Like, I get it. You've got to make hard decisions to protect the group. Understand it.
Yeah.
There is no reason to leave this family behind, as best I can tell.
Again, I think they could have done a better job if they wanted to make this seem like this is a thing that we hate to do, but it's very necessary. Like I said, mm-hmm. We are mice people. We are not hawks. We are not serpents. We are not badgers or foxes. We live by fitting in between the seams and hiding in the shadows, which is fine. But again, it's a twisted ankle. It's a twisted ankle, and they have carts. Mm-hmm. Like, they were literally carting around the big fellow in the back of their cart, is there not a single family in this tightly knit group that'd be like, you know what, we'll take the guy for a cart for half a day, and then this family can take him for half a day, and then this family can take him for half a day. Like, it was just like, nope, you're not only banished, but you're at the back of the pack.
Uh-huh.
And if they said, like, you know, like I said, if there's wolves chase them, if there was some kind of famine where it's like, seriously, if we don't leave, you know, like, we're not saying you can't come with, but you got to keep up a pace, because if we don't get this next valley in the next X amount of time, like, we'll miss the harvest and we're all going to die in the winter. But they didn't establish any real stakes.
Nope.
The stake was he had a swollen ankle to probably be fine with a week or so of rest. And that was enough to get. And then that's the thing. It's like essentially a death sentence being put at the back of the caravan. We're just going to outwalk you. So I don't know. I liked it in theory. And the other thing that left me a little cold is when they made a joke about the dumb guy getting stung to death by bees.
All right.
When Sadok is like, this guy died because of a beehive. Uh-huh. He never was that smart. It's like, God, they're talking shit about the beloved dead that they're all crying about.
I don't know. I didn't have much of a problem with that. I kind of enjoyed it. They're remembering him humorously.
Alex says, what really got to me is how ridiculously passive Sauron turned out to be. Going into this show, I expected to see a master manipulator spinning webs of lies. Instead, he basically sits back and lets things happen to him all season. Galadriel picked him up from the ocean. Galadriel saw a sigil and decided to make him king. He sat in jail for a while in Numenor. Then the Numenoreans took him to the Southlands and fought with the orcs with him in tow. Galadriel decided to bring him to the elves after he was wounded. Only in the last episode did he show up at the forge, have a 5-minute chat with Celebrimbor, admit that he was Sauron to Galadriel, and then leave. Just doesn't seem like he had a plan at all. It just felt like his entire plot was reverse engineered from a desire to have a cool reveal where a surprising character turned out to be Sauron, and that happened at the expense of actually developing a compelling villain.
I mean, I feel that a little bit, but I wonder if he had a plan. I mean, he was trying to embed himself in the Builders Guild, right? In Numenor. And getting his blacksmith skills into their systems there. I feel like he might have been trying to, you know, forge some rings there on Numenor, and this Galadriel thing was an annoyance to him. But he eventually realized, I could probably do this and maybe get to my goal a little faster.
Yeah. Honestly, I think everything tracks except for how he got on that boat. Like, if I understood if that was a desperate gamble, if that was a calculated play, if that was just him, you know, Like, was he just in the right place at the right time, and is all a coincidence and serendipity?
Mm-hmm. That's what it seems like, but
because otherwise, yeah, when he got to Numenor, he was as they outlined in the plot, he was locked into a goal, and Galadriel kept on fucking with him. Like, I want to stay in Numenor and do smithing. No, we got to do this. Oh, Jesus Christ! And then once they got there, he fought against. I thought it's really well done, except for how he got there. And maybe they will explain that next season when him and Adar meet up, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Lindsay says, I'm looking forward to Adar versus Sauron showdown this next season, now that Sauron seems to be heading to Mordor. The reveal that Halbrand to Sauron really gave new meaning to the moment when Halbrand asked Adar if he remembered him, especially since Adar thinks he killed Sauron. I doubt we get in a flashback to the original fights, and Sauron obviously must have not looked like Charlie Vickers at the time, but I'm looking forward to the rematch.
I mean, he might have had all that armor on. Be tough to recognize anybody out of that armor.
It's true. That's true. Yeah. No, I think they might flashback to the battle, and I hope that what we don't get is next season is Sauron standing, you know, bloodied with Adar's head at his feet and all the orcs are like, you know, doing obeisance to him. It's like, I really do need to see how he wins Mordor just by himself with no ring of power, no nothing. Mm-hmm. He has got to co-opt either Adar's got to be working with him all the time, which I don't think is the case, or he's got to co-opt Adar or eliminate Adar and not have the orcs turn on him and then devote themselves entirely to forging of the One Ring.
Yeah. I'm also curious how Adar can think that he killed Sauron and Sauron not actually be dead. I'm sure there's magic involved. I'm sure there's some, you know, in-world obvious explanation, but I kind of would like to know what happened there.
Yeah, because, like, it's one thing when Gandalf gets killed by the Balrog, because I'm sure the Balrog, as he's dying, it's like, well, at least I got that fucker, and he expires. And then Gandalf's spirit goes back to Middle-earth heaven, and the gods are like, we're not done with you yet. We're sending you back. How the fuck does that happen to Sauron?
I don't know.
Especially since, like, they got it, and once he forges the ring, there's this idea that he's like Voldemort in Harry Potter. Like, he's got a Horcrux that even if his physical body dies, his spirit is tied to this plane and it can't leave, so it kind of dissipates, and eventually it'll coalesce somewhere. And once he gets the ring back, he's just as powerful as he was because it's got all of his power in it, right? Okay. But he doesn't have that. And why would the gods send him back? Like, this that's what doesn't make sense to me. Like, it makes sense that Adar kills him and his spirit would go to and fro and then coalesce somewhere else. But yeah, I don't know. Sauron's a great deceiver. He's a very satanic figure in more so than even, I think, Morgoth in the Lord of the Rings series, at least the deceiver angle of it. The Irish Monk says, I laughed every time you referred to the Swedish death metal Sauron followers. I'm guessing you don't know how right you are, because in 2006, actual Swedish death metal band Unleashed released a song, We Must Join With Him, and it's a banger. To prove your telepathic ways, here are a few lines from the first verse. Smoke is rising from the mountain, the mountains of doom. Okay, I can't do that. It's a little too much for my voice. Imagine Swedish death metal screaming. Mm-hmm. On the Tower of Barad-dûr, that's the name of Sauron's famous Black Tower, we must join with him, we must join with Sauron, or we have chosen death. Shit, the Butcher Baker Candlestick Maker could have said that as much this season. I just go with essentially a death clock Metalocalypse reference. Sure. I had no idea there was actually Swedish death metal bands repping Sauron out there.
Makes sense.
Thank you for
that. Makes sense. We got a lot of Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be right back after this short break. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday, covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss.
Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now, let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep.
Gene says, is Halbrand / Sauron sincere in his mission to heal Middle-earth? And is his regret real? I submit to you a quote from journalist H.L. Mencken. The urge to save humanity is almost always a false face for the urge to rule it. This is true even if you believe you want to save the world. It's a warning about powerful people bearing gifts like Sauron or Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. I thought it was a plot hole that Halbrand / Sauron didn't just kill Galadriel at the river, but perhaps he's smitten with her. All that genocide talk may have given him an evil boner. Do you think that Halbrand knew that he was Sauron the whole time, or did he have a veil over his memories like Meteor Man? I'm finally pleased we get to see Sauron in his fair form. Will we get to see a full-on Sauron character arc? So what do you think? What do you think about Sauron being legit, being evil, being good?
I mean, people who do bad things can believe they're doing good things.
Yes.
I don't think the idea of like doing a bad thing and thinking you're doing good is mutually exclusive. So I certainly believe it. I mean, if I look at Adar, I think he's in that position, right? He thinks that he's going to unite Middle Earth. He's just got some twisted ways of going about it. And I think the end goal there is looks a lot different than a lot of people in Middle Earth would like it to look. So yeah, Sauron could definitely be the same way. I was definitely getting like vibes where he is into Galadriel in, I don't even know if it's sexual, right? It's a weird like attraction sort of way though.
Power,
yeah. Ruling together, power. Yeah. All that stuff. Definitely getting those vibes. But yeah, I mean, his ideal Middle Earth might be hell for some and heaven for him, right?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I was listening to David Chin's Decoding TV podcast on this, and his co-host Don read something from the Silmarillion where it said, essentially asked the same question, where it's like, you know, Sauron repented and humbled himself and gave himself a fair form and kind of wormed his way into the elves and men of various times. And the book asks a rhetorical question. It's like, was this remorse genuine, you know, at seeing the downfall of Morgoth and regretting the error of his ways? Or was it just the fear of hell, essentially? Like, oh my God, I saw Morgoth getting thrown into the pit of darkness forever. I don't want to do that. So I'm going to try to get right. And this isn't completely insincere, but like, it seems like from the point of view of the universe in Tolkien's writings that they're kind of unsure. So I kind of think it's cool that we ourselves are unsure. And I think that episode 8 did a particularly good job of threading that, where it's like, is Sauron just fucking with Galadriel and manipulating her? Or is there a genuine love there and respect? Is there a genuine desire to undo some of the bad things that his boss had done? Does he feel genuine regret and it's going to, he's eventually going to regress back to his mean? I don't know. And I think that's cool.
Yeah. Does he want to be tempered by the light? Yeah. No, it's an interesting idea.
This is one of the things where I think they're really, like, in House of the Dragon, I'm really impressed by how they're like representing all the points of view in the universe, like somehow through the actual events. And I think that Lord of the Rings of Power with Sauron and his present state of character development is really nailing that kind of like in-universe hand-wringing about what's actually going on here. What's the actual truth? Mm-hmm. It's representing that accurately, and I think that's cool. Storlax says, quick note regarding Nori and Gandalf on an adventure together. I realize that lore purists out there might look at the stranger's decision to vacation in Rune as a reason to outright disprove that we're dealing with Gandalf, but I think it's important to remember that just because the Istar and Nori have set off to follow their noses towards Rune, that doesn't necessarily mean they will actually get there. Mm-hmm. Plenty of ordinary folk in the world ahead that could delay them, as well as many darknesses to keep them at bay that might not allow them to pass along the way. Yeah,
sure. Information they could discover that changes where they want to go, you know?
But I do think that, yes, anything could happen, right? Mm. And you can do anything as long as it's well done. I do think that they spent a lot of time setting up this, what is it, Miter's hat or what, Miser's hat? I can't remember the star cluster that you can only see from Rune.
Oh, Hermit's. Feels,
the Hermit's cap?
Yeah.
That it feels like a lot of that's going to be wasted screen time if they never make it to Rune, if that's just a MacGuffin destination. So, like, I do think there's a mystery there that needs to be explored, and I think they will. But we'll see. Sam H. says, I'm good has to be the lamest climatic line for a magical incineration of the Swedish death metal band and reveal for Gandalf. This flip-flops almost as ridiculous as the Harfoot crew semi-successfully fighting and evading those Sauron-worshipping magical beings. That section left a very children's book compared to a story that is otherwise going for serious fantasy, and I always feel like it's misplaced. None of the Nori or Harfoot sections all season have been fun or interesting to me, but maybe I'm just a hater. Overall, I've got many petty gripes and criticism of the show, but being honest, I'll definitely be watching next season, albeit with lower expectations than I came to this show with. You know, I noticed that Dave and Don were really bagging on this I'm good line, and it didn't occur to me to criticize it because it was so Iron Giant, and I love Iron Giant so much that, like, maybe a very powerful but simple-minded being just standing up and saying I'm good actually gets me, but I didn't think that was a stupid line.
No, it didn't register as stupid to me at all. But maybe I'm just not properly calibrated.
Yeah, maybe we're the simple-minded ones here.
Because
having a person stand at the evil and be like, I'm good, actually, is kind of laughable. But in the scene, I really was gripped up, and I was excited to see him blow those moth people to hell, you know? That was a statement. Final. Plus, also, it's like, is he good or is he evil? We've been saying that, and he just saying, I'm good. Like, finally, we get an answer.
If he was like, I got this, I would definitely have noticed that.
Yeah.
But I'm good. Didn't register.
Yeah. And as far as the Harfoot, man, like, I think that you're in good company for criticizing the show, because I think podcast is a fair representation of how the community feels about this show. That is gorgeous, and the craftsmanship is exquisite, and the plot succeeds about half of the time. However, most people's bright spot on the plot does include the Harfoots and the dwarves and Elrond. So you're kind of in thin company there, but I mean, I don't know.
I feel like we're dead center on the two extremes of the fandom or not fandom here. Like, I don't see a lot of people saying, hey, this show is flawed, but it has some really bright spots. What I see is half the people saying, this show fucking sucks. It's the worst thing I've ever seen. This is an atrocity to Tolkien.
Yeah.
And then I see the other half going, it's amazing. Look at all, you know, the horse riding scenes, and look at how beautifully they're integrating like this particular plot element from the book. I see very rarely people having measured views on this show. And of course, right, it's the internet. That it's a hype and angst machine. That is what the internet does nowadays. So yeah, I try to just give my opinion, and it's I don't hate the show, and I don't love this show. I think it's a fine show for the most part with some serious flaws.
Yeah. I agree with that. And I also agree that, like, I will be watching next season, again, schedule permitting, but this is a show that's, you know, got a lot of eyeballs on it. It does things, some things extraordinarily well. The biggest flaw, I think, is the inexperience of the showrunners and the writers. And that's something that can be fixed just with experience. Like, they'll be better next year, you would hope. But I don't know, because, like, here's the other thing. Scott Gimple was a staff writer in The Walking Dead that wrote some pretty fucking good episodes. Mm-hmm. And on the basis of that one season of excellence, they gave him the keys of the kingdom. We're flipping a lot of keys in this podcast for some reason. They flipped in the keys of the kingdom and said, you are now The Walking Dead. And I think it went to his head, because instead, from that point forward, instead of being like, okay, I've done a lot of good things, but there's also some criticism here, it's almost like he's like, nah, no one knows what the fuck they're talking about except for me. And ruined the show. Like, he was supposed to be the savior. He was supposed to be the one that brings balance to the writing, and he just fucking ruined it. And then Angela Kang has come in and has tried to, like, give it a good send-off. If I come back to this season and I see the preseason, and they're going to be asked, you know, there's a lot of criticism of the last season show. What do you make of that? And if they're like, you know what, we've read that and that's stupid, and we're going to trust in our own judgment, and we know what's good, right, and wrong, because there's a lot of fans that loved it for exactly who, and that's the show, I'm going to be like, oh, fucking Christ. But if they're like, you know what, yeah, we are inexperienced, and we did learn a lot in that first year, and I think fans are going to see us mature as storytellers going forward, I'm going to be like, thank God they can be taught. Because... Sure. That's what the Picard writers said going into season two. They're like, actually, we thought season one was awesome and there's no problems and people just need to suck it. And surprise, surprise, season two, hot garbage. Mm-hmm. So, like, can they be taught? Are they humble enough? And they should be. Jesus Christ. They don't know. They're Jon Snow's. They know nothing. They should try to triangulate on the feedback. You know, they can't, you know, you can't make a show to please everybody, but I think they should do harder to shore up the weaknesses that they had in the season.
Yeah, I don't know what their opinions on their own work is, because what I'm getting from all the articles I read about them prior to this season, talking about how they've been writing for 25 years together. And by the way, when they say that, they're talking about middle school plays that they did.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know if they're properly calibrated on that, because writing a middle school play for 25 years is entirely different than writing the biggest budget show in the history of cinema. So,
yeah, agreed.
I don't know if you come away from that going, well, we've been writing for so long, obviously we're experienced. So it's not experience. It's not that we can learn anything new from that. It's more, we just didn't write to people's taste. I could see them coming away from it with that. Because I just don't know. Like, the way it's been portrayed is they are longtime writing partners who have a history and a substantial catalog under their belts. I just don't see it from their IMDb credits. Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see two shows that they've written episodes for or whatever, and that's kind of it. But, like, do they see it that way? Do they see themselves as needing some tempering in this kind of experience, or do they see themselves as like seasoned already?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I know what I'm hoping on, but we'll have to see.
Because the media sees them as seasoned, which is crazy to me. Crazy that everybody's like 25-year veterans. I'm like, show me their catalog.
That's the thing about Hollywood writing is there was a lot of like uncritical parroting of that, but also almost without fail, they would write, they would like make sure that people knew that like they don't have any screenwriting credits. Like they're, I wish they'd made the connection earlier. And maybe, I don't know. I don't know. Because I don't, like, apparently J.J. Abrams vouched for these guys.
Oh, why? That's who I want vouching for my, the bastion of creative cinema that is J.J. Abrams these days. That's what I want.
Has J.J. Abrams' star fallen that far? Because he's done some fucking good shit, man. Is it? Is
it really in my mind, I don't know.
Yeah, I just got to see like how do they feel about this? Because if they got any humility and any appreciation for where they're at, I think they could learn from valid criticisms. And I think there are some valid criticisms this season and course correct. But we'll see. August P has a pretty hot meme for us. It says Expanse writers, hey, Jeff Bezos, interested in adapting our highly regarded final trilogy? Bezos. And it's just a screenshot of the stranger saying, I'm good. Great reaction. Yeah. Great reaction gif. Him just saying, I'm good. You can just use that to like, hey, do you want us to get Taco Bell for you tonight? I'm good. Jamie H. says, I'd like to collect my internet points because in the feedback for the first two episodes, I wrote that Galadriel's shipwreck friend, a.k.a. Halbrand, was totally Sauron. I had no evidence at the time other than he was shady as fuck, but I was right. Please send all internet points to my Gmail account. I've transferred all of the internet points to your account. You'll notice it's still zero because it turns out this game is rigged and the points don't matter, but you got them. The thing is, the brilliant thing about the Sauron thing is I think 100% tracks in retrospect. And if I got to say all the things they had to do this season, that's one of the things they would have to do. And I think they did that pretty fucking good. You know, I know it comes off as passive or, you know, apparently to some people, but like that fact that after the fact that plot tracks clean was pretty nifty, pretty nifty. Now this season is over, I'm curious, what are some of the tweaks you think the show needs to make next season to tighten up the story? I think the writer's room needs adjusting. Some of the dialogue is really clunky this season. It detracts from the gorgeous visuals. Jim, what I've got at least one big suggestion, I think, that would instantly make the show better. But do you have anything?
Boy. At this point, like if we're talking big changes, I think they just need to do, they need to make the connective tissue more connective. I'm not able to connect the dots on a lot of the stuff they're doing if they're in fact doing it. You know, we talked about the Isildur stuff. If that's where they're going with it, it's almost too subtle. They're not telling us that they're going to tell us a story with that. They're just kind of putting it out there. I don't know, man. This stuff is hard because a lot of the problems I have with this show are not things you can point to and say, well, if they just did this one thing, it would fix it. They need to write better. But how do you describe that, right? How do you tell people, like, here's how you write better?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Here's my suggestion. You guys, next season, are not allowed to open or close a puzzle box. You need to concentrate on ditching the reliance of surprise and shock in favor of clear, understandable motivations of characters that we have come to either love or hate. That's all. It's not about what's in the box. It's not about what the rusty sword does. It's not about who the nature of this person hanging out with the hobbits for the entire fucking season. Mm-hmm. It's how we feel about the characters, whether we love them or hate them, and whether we understand their motivations enough to be invested in them. Because I felt like this show held us at arm's length for most of the season, just so they can, in episode 8, blow our fucking minds with the stranger's actually Gandalf, probably, and Halbrand's actually Sauron, and all this other stuff, when they could have played this stuff at face value. Maybe the Sauron's the one thing you couldn't. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't know why they made the western half of Numenor so fucking mysterious. I don't know why Isildur's mother's fate is so mysterious. I don't know why Isildur's brother was never seen and only referenced once. I don't understand why there was so many important things. I don't know why Galadriel didn't have a husband until episode 6. Sorry, episode 7. Mm-hmm. I don't know why these major things don't get... I mean, it's like, imagine watching fucking Mad Men, and you get all the way through season 1 until you find that Don's married.
Sure.
He's just this playboy guy, and it turns out he's got this perfect, picturesque 1950s house. That would kind of like, what the, where did that, just stop. No, you don't, and honestly, that's something the Mad Men learned from. They tried to make, you know, Don kind of a puzzle box, and they quickly abandoned, you know, that was kind of the one thing they did, and they kind of abandoned it and moved on. But, like, I just think that that's a cheap way to get audience engagement and community interaction.
Oh, yeah. And it's not in Lord of the Rings DNA, right? Like, I've never felt watching any of the movies like, oh, who is this character? You know, is this guy like actually this other character? No, it's always very straightforward. You know, where people are aligned. Are they good? Are they evil? Yeah. Or are they tempted?
Or, ooh,
you know,
Sauron, when he gets that ring, what's he going to do with it? Ooh, who knows? Mm-hmm. It could be... No, he's going to fucking
unite the
world.
Yeah,
he's going to bind them all in darkness. Like, it's...
Right.
You know that. You know that. That's the simplicity in his archetypes. Like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't feel like confident storytelling when you have all these mysteries and... It's just better when you have clear, simple motivations that pay off in grand ways. You know, someone said to something I thought interesting is that because of serendipity, both House of the Dragon and Rings of Power had an old king die. Mm-hmm. One was the most incredible thing you've probably seen all year. And the other one was just some black flags that the person who's most impacted by it couldn't even see. And just kind of spinning around 360 like, oh, what does it all mean? We knew exactly what it fucking meant when the other king died. It's mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's indicative of you had the exact amount, same amount of time to establish these characters and what they meant to people and what it meant when they died. Mm-hmm. But like, I think most people probably don't. It's like, well... I don't know. Farazone, is he a good bet? Is Queen Muriel? I don't know. I think they wasted too much time in the puzzle boxes. Anyway, do you have any hopes for things we'll see next season? I would love to see the Ents integrated into the story somehow. I would love to see Ents. That's kind of it. I guess I would like for my private stranger theory to pay off, but you know, that's just me being selfish.
Okay. I guess I expect some more rings to show up. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that is going to be interesting. The rings, how the elves find out about them. I would like for them to hint that I'd like to see the elves' decision to be selfish with the rings bite them in the ass too.
Yeah.
The problem is there's already so many reasons for enmity between the dwarves and the elves right now.
Sure.
Like, you turned your back when you could have saved us. Well, you tried to steal our mithril and broke your oath to the mountain. And it's like, I don't know. The idea, like, they also really soft-pedaled the idea that the dwarves helped Celebrimbor build his forge, and that wasn't ever really acknowledged. The fact that the forge was built, the fact that dwarves weren't there anymore, the fact that that was a pretty big joint operation they did. So I'd like to see some more of that. RG from Texas said, one episode to redeem them all and maybe the entire season for me. After experiencing the debacle episode 7, which I thought was the worst of the season so far, I was really afraid for episode 8. I really want to watch this. I really want to like the series. When episode 8 cold opened to reveal falsely that Stranger was Sauron, I literally turned off the television. However, the best episodes or best scenes of episode 8 also had the ability to make them the worst and lose us all. First, a misdirection that the stranger was Sauron, only to hint that it was Halbrand slowly. I bring gifts, devices of power over flesh, etc. To then have the wizard be revealed in such a powerful scene was truly amazing. However, if the stranger turned out to be Sauron, then it would have been a huge disappointment. The other scene was when Halbrand revealed himself to Galadriel. How he went from seducing her to finally trying to coerce her was so good that I almost believed she would accept. Obviously, if she would have, even for half a second, it would have been a major upset. Sadly, I think this is a weakness of the show. I feel like every episode they are swinging for the fences, many times falling flat. Likewise, every 10 minutes a character is supposed to say something wise or powerful but falls flat as dialogue. For example, when Nori says goodbye to Poppy, in a very emotional scene, Poppy says, "It seems like everyone I love goes away." Nori responds to the effect of, "That's how we learn." Take away the acting and the beautiful scenery and the music, and it's a horrible thing to say to an orphan. Next time you give condolences to someone, drop in, "And otherwise we wouldn't learn," and let me know how that works out for you. In short, it's a great episode, but I felt like the entire season was the showrunners were playing Little League Baseball, trying to hit a home run with every time they were at bat to swing. When they hit it, it's amazing. And when they struck out, it was awful to see.
Yeah, imagine Babe Ruth points to the stands in the outfield every time he gets up to bat, right?
Yeah.
That one time he hits it out of the park where he says he's going to is not nearly as impressive.
Right, right. This is the time he just grounds out the first. And I think you're right. I will say this, that if I had to choose between showrunners that just play it safe and try to go middle of the road for showrunners that take big swings and big ambitious things, and I would definitely bet, I definitely prefer the latter than the former. But also, it's hard to judge when you have literally first timers doing it, because like maybe you could say that you have to earn the right to take those big swings. Like if a guy just walks onto the squad and just starts swinging at everything and striking out, yeah, guy's an asshole. But if like your team captain says, "You know what? I'm gonna swing for the fences on this one, boys." Fine. Yeah, do it. Let's see there, slugger. And I feel like a lot of these swings would have connected better if they had a better person. And they did. They had much more experienced people, Jones to direct and show run this thing, and they passed them up in favor of these guys. So
yeah.
Adam says, let me start with what I thought was good. I loved the Nori and Stranger stuff. I got teary-eyed at the end, and the adventure of those two characters are what's going to bring me back for season two. I also loved the Elrond character, who I think, and the actor who I think does such a good job. I wish he were in the Lord of the Rings movies, with no slight towards Hugo Weaving. Oh, you can't take Hugo Weaving out of the Elrond.
No.
I wish I could watch him for a solid hour each week. Now onto the bad. I thought the Forging of the Rings, which is the centerpiece of the show, was a major disappointment. After years of reading about that moment, imagining in my head I was looking forward to it. Would it be in darkness? Would there be terror present? But when it was shown to us, it was made so ordinary and plain that I wish they hadn't. There was no mystery, no sense of power being created, no sense of danger. It was a goofy Santa's workshop moment with very little to separate it from any other scene in the show. In fact, it reminded me of the midichlorians. All my life, the Force had been this intangible thing that flowed through the universe and shaped it. Then Lucas introduced midichlorians suddenly, and the magic was made ordinary. That was the forging of the Elven Rings for me. Maybe this is a little bit too... Like, I didn't get the sense that they were forging these world-altering objects. Like, there was no thrum of power. There was no putting on of the ring and, like, something, you know, wind rushing in. It just, yeah, it just felt like watching people make rings. Not particularly impressive or pretty ones.
Yeah, I think if we get another ring forging scene, it's probably going to be what you're hoping it would be, right? There will be a lot of darkness around it. There will be a lot of humming and then thrumming and just, yeah, it'll be a lot more intense, right?
Yeah. If I'm going to play devil's advocate, because I largely agree with this critique, It might be something in Tolkien-esque that, like, sometimes simple things, unassuming things are the most powerful things. And you could say that applies to hobbits. You could say the One Ring is just canonically a simple gold ring.
Yeah.
There's no engraving that's obvious about it. There is no jewel. There's nothing to draw your attention to it other than the fact that it magically resizes itself to match the shape of your finger.
And it calls out to you. Yeah.
it rips you into the shadow realm when you put it on. But, like, it looks utterly mundane. So, like, they might be going for, like, you just can't judge a book by its cover kind of thing.
Yeah.
Adam says, I also cannot get over Galadriel not telling the others about Sauron, a person she has hunted for centuries. There's many justifications we could lob towards this, but ultimately I do not believe that her character would keep this knowledge secret, nor do I think she would abandon her search for him.
Yeah, what do I agree you with think that criticism. I was throughout that episode thinking, God, is she really not going to tell anybody what's going on here?
Yeah.
At least what her suspicions are, and she can go confirm that, but... Yeah.
I didn't. The thing is that they've portrayed Galadriel impetuous enough that she might genuinely be afraid of the censure that she would face for allowing Sauron to get back into the world.
Going to send her to Valinor again, and she's going to have to swim another 100 miles.
Right. Like, she essentially, like, Gil-galad said as much, like, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go in there and you're going to by seeking it, you're going to cause it. And broadly speaking, he's right. And it's almost like, well, I don't want to be told about it. So she just keeps it to herself. But, and I don't think it's very Galadriel-like, but they are selling her as this very impetuous, not thinking things through type of elf. And
as soon as she confirms it, Sauron's honor, right? It's not like she got all this information and had a day to stew on it and consider, oh, should I tell them or shouldn't I? It's like she got the scroll, Halbrand shows up, he reveals he's Sauron in visions, and she's floating face down in a river, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, why would Sauron leave her alive?
I don't know. He's got a thing for her, it seems.
Yeah. I think he thinks he can still use her.
Yeah,
I think the fact that she's not saying that it's Sauron says that maybe he's right. It's too bad because she's really abusing Elrond's trust here. He says, I'm never going to not trust you again. She immediately does something untrustworthy and legitimately so. And it feels like a betrayal because, yeah, like them, her saying, like, we should never deal with Halbrand again. And Celebrimbor and Elrond's like, okay, I guess we won't fuck with this minor southern lord, you know, this king of the south that may or may not exist. But also, don't you think Elrond's kind of stupid for not at least thinking it might be Sauron?
I don't know. Why would he be stupid for that?
So he found the scroll that shows that Halbrand is a lie. He knows he's a talented smith. He knows a little bit more about the forging of magic things than maybe he should.
But doesn't the episode just end there? Like, he runs up to the tower going, oh no, something is amiss here. He looks at it, they've already forged the rings, and the episode ends, right? Like,
no, he goes back and tells Galadriel, and she says, doesn't she eventually say, you just got to trust me, man. You said you would trust me blindly just 30 minutes ago in the episode, and I need you to trust me blindly.
I thought she said that to him before he found the scroll.
You might be right.
Yeah.
Because if Elrond guesses by early next season it's Sauron, then it won't be. But still, it's a shitty thing that Galadriel did.
Yeah.
Finally, before we get into lore corner, Abdul from the UK says, look at the CV, the curriculum vitae. Is that how you pronounce that? Sure. Of Ronald D. Moore before Battlestar Galactica, or Damon Lindelof before Lost or Leftovers and The Watchmen. What are the chances that Amazon fires the showrunners of T-Rop? Their interview in The Hollywood Reporter was an embarrassing admission of being in over their heads. It's interesting because, like, I feel like from the tone of this message, he's saying, like, compare the CVs of Ronald Moore and Damon Lindelof, but, like, they legit had, like, Ronald D. Moore was largely responsible for Deep Space Nine.
Uh-huh.
That's a pretty fucking bright
next
point.
Generation, too, yeah.
A lot of fucking bright points and the shows that he could actually run a science fiction show actually. Damon Lindelof had a ton of primetime scripted dramas that he had served as a staff writer before he got his big shot on Lost. Mm-hmm. And then by the time he gets to Leftovers, like, he had a checkered reputation because not everybody loved Lost. But since then, it's just like, yeah, Damon Lindelof, what a storyteller. So those guys are exceptions to the, like, first, because they're not first time showrunners. It was a natural, they cut their teeth under more experienced people as a part of a larger writing room. They got promoted to staff writers. Then they got promoted to showrunners. You know, like, that is a natural mm-hmm. progression. These guys, I mean, it's just, it'd be like, it's honestly, guys, it's just as shocking as if you found out that me, Jim and Aaron, were showrunning the Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power. Because everything they say about themselves, sure. we could say honestly, like, oh, we've been working together for 30 years and we've worked on creative and script to draw. Like, literally as much experience as these guys had. I would never
not trust myself with a show like this or any show.
I can't imagine the temerity to put your name forward for show running this show with that little experience. It would never even occur to me to do that, to be like, call my rich and famous friend and be like, hey, we really got this idea for this thing. And, you know, we're like in our mid 30s now and we're not happy with where we're at in our career. Someone give us a leg up. Like, I don't know why they asked. I don't know why someone interceded. I don't know why that intercession worked. Like, it's a mystery to me why you would give these showrunners this project. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I would say that even before we saw the outcome of it, right? Like, yeah. Why is the biggest show on the planet not being run by the biggest showrunners on the planet? Why do you not call in somebody who's extraordinarily popular right now?
Yeah.
To do that.
Go back and listen to our preview podcast. That was essentially our point of view. Well, our first coverage is like the one thing that makes you give pause to this project is the fact that the showrunners have no experience, as far as I can tell. And the experience they do have is like schlocky stuff, like some kind of vampire web series, or it's like Jim said, some kind of junior high production of something or something. It's like, it wasn't great. It wasn't great. There's a lot more Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be back right after this short break.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Now,
let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep.
That's going to do it for this week, except for the lore corner. Stick around for that. But I know some people don't like to hear the spoilers, the potential spoilers of that. They might be leaving us now. We will have one more wrap-up podcast where we talk about, you know, and I don't know how long it'll be, but it'll be essentially us trying to divine when the show is going to come back, see if there's any retrospective the creators might have given to give us insight into what went wrong and what went right. I'll always like reading those kind of post-mortem interviews. And so we'll have that out next week. Follow along. You know, we're still run strong on Hot D. We got a lot of stuff coming up for the end of this year and beginning of next year at baldmove.com. Follow us on twitter.com/baldmove. Dug2deep@baldmove.com is how you get feedback in for the last wrap-up episode. And now we're going to talk to John from the Lorehounds for the Lore Corner. Joining me now from the Lorehounds is both John and David, back from his sojourn through Middle Earth. Welcome back to the Lore Corner, guys.
Thanks, Aaron. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We got a smattering of lore stuff here at the end of all things. Mike is up first. He's wanting to talk about the cultists. So both the podcasts, I presume he's talking about Bald Move and Lorehounds, have speculated on the possible elvish origins of the Swedish death metal band members. I'd like to point out that the helm, the member, has clearly human ears. Unless the cult clips elf ears like to do their dogs, I'd wager that all three of them are human. You know, I didn't take a look at him because I imagine we got better looks at their ears in this last episode. Turns out they're just moth people.
Yes.
they're moth spirits. But like I swear to God, until episode 8, we never got to look at a straight up look on these people's ears. The helmet covered the ears. I don't know. Maybe you got elf eyes.
We talk about these. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say what. Yeah, go ahead.
We talk about these the Swedish death metal band, the band on our podcast that came out today. And I was really confused for a long time because they had elven like bearing, you know, that sort of haughty reservedness. Mm-hmm. And so I was really confused for the longest time. And then John convinced me that they're probably humans.
Oh, I was thinking, well, at this point, they're probably Maiar, right? Maya?
I don't know. They're really playing fast and loose with this magic
stuff. I haven't,
again,
because you guys release this on the day that we compile and record the feedback. I haven't listened to your guys' feedback yet, or your guys'
yeah,
episode yet. But I wondered, did you make any connection between the moths that Gandalf is whispering into and the moth of the person that got banished into the Shadow Realms? Because it looks
like we
didn't
chat about it, but I heard you bring that up.
Yeah, it looked very Gandalf friend to me, but I don't know.
This is where they're doing this thing with the stranger and coding him with a lot of Gandalfian traits.
Yeah.
And is it just them messing with us, or is it really going to play out now? With Halbrand, they were playing him out the whole time, and he told us who he was very early on, if we go back and listen. So, is it? I think they're playing with us, clearly, because that moth was completely a Gandalf thing.
I think that Gandalf went to these guys, these Maiar in the Third Age, and said, look, you jumped me, I banished you to the Shadow Realms, but we're going to be cool, we're going to be even in everybody's books if each of you relays at least one message to an eagle. And he's still got one of those in his pocket. He's still got one. So they each owe him a message, and nice. he got to collect on two of them. Let's get to the real lore meat here, because Mike says...
Real quick, plug. We've got our season wrap-up coming, and we're going to be interviewing Marilyn Pukila, our in-house Tolkien expert, and that is going to be a subject of conversation is... What do these three people represent? Not so much going into the canon or not canon of them, but like mytho-historically, like what do these different figures represent for the story? So we're going to definitely get into that. So keep an ear out for that coming out next week.
All right. Mike is getting to the heart of the lore where I was like, oh, wigga wigga what now? Of elf man couplings. This has come up several times in both podcasts with the famous three discussed each time. But why no mention of the elf Mithraeus and her supposed Numenorean husband, Imrizor, who became the founding couple of the line of princes of Dol Amroth. Granted, I think it was just a legend, but should at least be worth mentioning. Out of the big three, I've never heard of this particular story. What say you, John?
I say that they have the rights to the appendices, and they have some relationship with the Tolkien estate to get maybe some things out of the Silmarillion. And this is coming out of Unfinished Tales, and they are not going anywhere near that.
Yeah, that seems like the estate would three flavors of pounds.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's the dollars and cents answer for sure. Moving on to Abdul from the UK says, a question for the Lorehounds. I've listened to your pods on the rights, but why were the Tolkien estate so restrictive in particular in their negotiations? They don't know TV, so why hamstring Amazon ahead of selling the rights?
So I did a little bit more digging around today and thinking about this question. And if we step back and we think about what intellectual property is out there that is available to make TV and films from, we know that Tolkien sold the rights in 69, and that was to The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, and the rights to make film and television and explore a bunch of other stuff. There's some other vague language in there about what else they can do. There's a weird carve out that says TV shows under 8 episodes or less are not included. I don't know how that gets interpreted, but that's somewhere in the language.
It must have been during the era of the miniseries. They're like, oh, well, you may have to do a miniseries, and that's not going to be the same thing as a television show. So
right. So the Tolkien estate still owns the book rights, right? Those are theirs, mm-hmm. and they're in an obligation with HarperCollins on those rights. So like whenever they do anything with book stuff, they have to do it in conjunction with HarperCollins. So if we look at a lot of the other stuff, the Silmarillion, Beren and Lúthien, The Fall of Gondolin, The Children of Húrin, Unfinished Tales, The History of Middle Earth, guess whose name is on all of that stuff? Christopher Tolkien. Christopher Tolkien was the person who brought all of that material together, and that's whose name is listed as the editor of that stuff. So now we get into even more gray area of rights about who has the authority to issue those rights and sell them. Now we know that, no, we don't know. We speculate. There's a lot of speculation that Christopher was not happy watching his father have to sell the rights in 69 to pay off a tax bill. And there has long been a lot of things, people reading the tea leaves, both about Tolkien and about Christopher, about their attitudes towards making films and TVs and other adaptations. And the assessment is largely that Christopher has never been very positive about issuing those rights. So now the estate has the rights to these things ostensibly. So if Christopher's not very positive about having these things out there, did he say anything in his will? Does the estate have any instructions about what they can and they cannot do? So that's like a big question mark. We just don't know. It's very opaque. It's very hard to find information about this. Apparently, the showrunners do have an avenue to approach the estate to ask for specific things. But because they've given them the rights to the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings and the appendices, if there's a name that's hooked in there that another rights holder has license to, that gets into some really gray area stuff too. So now you've got HarperCollins, you've got New Line Cinema because they've got a claim in there. You have the lawyers, you have the estate. So it gets really complex to figure out, can we pull Annatar's name? Can we pull this name or that name or this location or that location? So I think that's my best answer for why has the estate been so restrictive. First of all, there's a lot of material out there that is not Tolkien's per se, and then it's just a very complex rights thing. And then with these other titles, I don't know, John might have an opinion because Silmarillion isn't really it's more like history of, what's the Targaryen history, Aaron?
Fire and Blood, yeah.
Yeah, it's dry. It's dry material, right?
Oh yeah. Well, no, it's like, it's kind of like first five books of the Bible stuff. I will say that. So like the long story, or long story short, is Tolkien probably never wanted to sell any television and movie rights. He was forced to by a tax bill that never sat right with his son. His son was very productive, but the rights were already out there. The horse was out of the barn, but Christopher wanted no more horses out of the barn. And I think I've heard on maybe your guys' podcast that maybe the younger generation of Tolkien's are a little bit more open to...
Simon Tolkien is very open. He's a scriptwriter. Yeah, Simon Tolkien, Christopher's son, has been on the record about wanting to see more material released.
And he's a consultant on the show, right?
One of them is
a consultant. One of the
Is he listed as a consultant?
I thought his granddaughter was the consultant.
Hmm.
Could be. Well, somebody from the Tolkien estate is a consultant, so it's not like... Yeah. This is not a hostile relationship.
Here. No, it's not a hostile, but like I feel like probably the state is divided itself. Like there's probably some that are like, yeah, let's make as much money respectfully as we can. There's some that's like, you know, grandpa didn't want it. Absolutely fucking not. Neither did dad. And there's others are probably kind of in, you know, so it's probably, I mean, I don't know. Have you gone, you know, if anyone's gone through an estate with family, like usually is not everyone's speaking with one voice. But it comes out that way from the state, and it seems like the flow right now is like, let's not let any more horses out as long as
at the same time this is my theory, this is my own personal theory, is that the estate is like, they're looking around and they're seeing how the rights are getting passed around because Embracer Group, and there's new trademarks being patented. They're aware that the MCU universe model is coming for them.
Yeah.
So I feel like the estate is like, well, let's get ahead of this. Let's tender. Amazon won that bid fair and square. It wasn't like Amazon didn't go to the estate. The estate said, hey, y'all come pitch us.
Mm-hmm.
And they liked Amazon's pitch the best because they want to be at the core of the conversation of how the rights are being rolled out, how additional properties are being developed. Because we're going to see a lot of video games.
Do you think we could get a House of the Dragon style show about the rights of the Tolkien estate? We just have a little view into the negotiations of who, which family member wants what released.
Succession. Yeah,
call one of them Team Hobbit and the other Team Mordor, and you would have a banger podcast following, if my experience is anything to go by. Okay. Hopefully that answers your question, Abdul. I think it's the best we can answer without getting interviews with the Tolkien estate. Caitlin T's up next. She says, I saw this on Twitter, pulled from Tolkien's 1951 letter to one Milton Waldman, a prospective publisher of The Silmarillion. I've heard McKay and Payne, that's the two showrunners, speak with their about their writing process a few times now. They gave a great interview with Joanna Robinson on The Ringer this week. She mentions parenthetically, so if you're interested in that, check it out. As well as Brian Cogman on his involvement at the beginning and how much care and detail they gave each line read. I think they know exactly what they want the story to be. So they included three snippets from this letter. No, but this is actually from the Silmarillion, I guess.
It is a letter. It's included at the front of many pressings of the Silmarillion.
Right. Okay. I thought maybe we could take turns reading this, maybe starting with John. You read the first snippet. David, you read this second, and I'll bring us home on the third.
All right.
Feels like second grade reading class.
Yes.
He repents in fear when the first enemy is utterly defeated. But in the end, does not do as was commanded, return to the judgment of the gods. He lingers in Middle-earth. I believe they're talking about Sauron here. Very slowly, beginning with fair motives, then reorganizing and rehabilitation of the ruin of Middle-earth, neglected by the gods, which is true. He becomes a reincarnation of evil and a thing lusting for complete power, and so consumed ever more fiercely with hate, especially of gods and elves. All through the twilight of the Second Age, the shadow is growing in the east of Middle-earth, spreading its sway more and more over men, who multiply as the elves begin to fade. The three main themes are thus: the delaying elves that lingered in Middle-earth, Sauron's growth into a new Dark Lord, master of god and men, and Numenor Atlantis.
All right, picking up, they wanted the peace and bliss and perfect memory of the West, and yet to remain on the ordinary earth where their prestige as the highest people above wild elves, dwarves, and men was greater than at the bottom of the hierarchy of Valinor. Thus, they became obsessed with fading, the mode in which the changes of time, the law of the world under the sun, was perceived by them. They became sad, and their art, shall we say, antiquarian, and their efforts all really a kind of embalming, even though they also retained the old motive of their kind, the adornment of the earth, and the healing of its hurts. We hear of a lineage, a lingering kingdom in the extreme northwest, more or less in what was left in the old lands of the Silmarillion under Gil-galad.
Finally, many of the elves listened to Sauron. He was still fair at that early time, and his motives and those of the elves seemed to go partly together. The healing of a desolate lands. Sauron found a weak point in suggesting that, helping one another, they could make Western Middle-earth as beautiful as Valinor. It was really a veiled attack on the gods, an incitement to try and make a separate, independent paradise. Gil-galad repulsed all such overtures, as did Elrond. But at Eregion, great work began, and the elves came nearest to falling to magic and machinery. With the aid of Sauron's lore, they made rings of power. Power is an ominous and sinister word in all of these tales, except as applied to the gods. The chief power of all the rings alike was a prevention or slowing of decay, i.e. change viewed as a regrettable thing, the preservation of what is desired or loved, or its semblance. This is more or less an elvish motive. But also, they enhanced the natural powers of a possessor, thus approaching magic, a motive more easily corruptible into evil and a lust for domination. So I want to sit and say that if you look back at the 30,000-foot view, these snippets are well represented in the first 8 episodes of this Rings of Power work.
Yeah.
I think some of the middle chapters are a little different than, they could have been a little cleaned up. But like most of the stuff, like the fact that I'm not so sure if Sauron is lying or not when he's saying this stuff to Galadriel about healing the earth and about being regretful and about feeling like all that stuff is in the text. The elves kind of being... You know, I wouldn't say the elves in this age are righteous and what their intentions or what they're trying to do necessarily is. They're essentially going against the will of the gods and how things should decline and change, and they're resisting that. I thought this was, like I said, that's why I think that we're in a pretty good shape at the end of this season, even though, again, I wish things had gone differently here and there. The foundation that they've laid after 8 episodes is very much in line of what I guess I was expecting from the show. And if they can just tighten some of the bolts that are loose, I think they're going to have something really special going forward.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron, you and I yelled a lot on the last Lorecast, but this week there was no venting of spleens. We were pretty largely positive on the episode because I think that you're right. It did accomplish a lot of these goals. And it did set us up for a good season, too. So I hope they can work out the pacing for next season. I laid down a controversial take on the last Lorecast where I said, you know, do we need the Numenorean plotline at all this season? Really, I think it just kind of detracted from the other storylines. But I think that they can fix a lot of this next season, especially if we get deeper into Numenor and the politics there and not just sort of using them as a set piece for other plot lines.
Yeah, I noticed that some people didn't bounce back. Like I was listening because I like listening to David Chin's podcast, and he's been kind of like simpatico with how I felt about the second half of the season. But he never really turned around on episode 8. And when I was listening to his coverage, it's like, you know, I think he was there's this kind of expressed disappointment that there's not more complexity, you know, than the kind of good versus evil struggle. But to me, that's a hallmark of Tolkien writing. Like, you're not ever going to get House of the Dragon. You're never going to get. No. And I know John's already a little bit comfortable because, you know, there's that there's a couple tales where Tolkien really lets the Halloween out. But by and large, it's going to be more of like there is a evil that might be tempted by good, but ultimately is going to reject its path for more evil. And there is good that might be tempted by evil, but it's going to stand firm and have their faith rewarded. And there's not going to be a lot of surprise deaths due to random chance and crazy shit. None of the, you know, main band of hobbits are going to be killed Not that they don't transform, but like, you know, broadly speaking, other than Boromir, who died because he gave in to corruption, you're not going to have the, like, you know, Game of Thronesian just kind of body counts and swings. And that's fine. It's fine to have well-told, gorgeous morality plays every once in a while, I think.
On the Lorecast, one of the things that we've been talking about is the Shippey test. So Tom Shippey, who's a one of the, you know, preeminent Tolkien scholars, he talks about, you know, when you have a different medium, and this all came about in reaction to the Jackson films. When you've got a different medium, there are changes that you're going to make it work. And you have to think about then, are you in the core of the story at the end of that adaptation? And are the changes that you made, do they serve the purpose of, you know, keeping you in that core, but because of television, movie, whatever, you had to, you know, stitch some lines together, put some characters in different places and that kind of stuff. And I think with episode 8, I'm firmly in the camp that they passed the Shippey test with this season. They've given us exactly what we just all three wrote here, which is the elves are obsessing. They're freaking out. They need to figure out some sort of stuff. And we've got Sauron, who thinks he's, you know, as he says, well, I don't see a difference between ruling and saving. It's the same thing to me. And then how that then turns very sour. And I think all of this stuff that we just read is well within the core of what they gave us on the screen.
And I think you have to contextualize this letter too. I believe Tolkien wrote this to a publisher who he was trying to convince that the Silmarillion was vital to The Lord of the Rings, because at the time he was trying to publish The Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion together. He wanted that to be a box set. And the publisher said, look, I don't get it. You need to just break this down for me. Can you pitch me the story of the Silmarillion, basically? And this is what he gave us. So I think that this is a good way to look at it, but also it is a bird's eye view, and I don't think it gets to all the nuances that he wanted. But I agree that this is a good thing to look at to show how the show is doing things right.
The publisher wanted hobbits. He didn't want like a tome, a history of Silmarillion stuff. Yeah, but anyway.
All right. Well, guys, thanks a lot for being our guide throughout the season here in the Lore Corner, and holding down the real serious heavy lifting on lore down on over on your Lorehounds podcast. Really appreciated. I've really benefited from your guys' analysis and details that you've been able to put into the show. And now it's time for us to sail west until next season, when hopefully the Valar will send us back to Middle Earth to complete our quest. Until that day comes, and people want to continue to listen to the Lorehounds, what are you guys going to be up to, and where can people find you?
Well, we decided just sort of on a quick reaction that we couldn't not talk about Andor. So we're going to jump into Andor. We should be releasing our first episode. We're going to recap episodes 1 through 6 this week. And then we're going to jump in. We've heard some different structure, how they're structuring the show. We might get 3, maybe 4 podcasts in on the rest of the season. And then over to what's next, John, after that?
We've got The White Lotus starting October 30th, and we're doing full coverage on that. We're doing a sort of a Bob Moose style recap and some lore research background. Lore is in like real world lore now, history, Sicily, things like that. So it'll be nice. You know, I've loved talking about elves, but it'll be nice to ground myself in Earth for a little while.
And then after that, the only other thing that we have definitively on the books is The Wheel of Time. And we're just waiting for Amazon to give us a release date for that. And then there we're going to go full bore. We're going to be doing, John's read all the books. I'm the, you know, the audience proxy, where I'm just coming into this pretty fresh. We both watched the season a couple of times. John's got the books, and we're going to do lore breakdown, feedback, all that good stuff, episode reactions. We'll see how we structure the season once we start, but expect full coverage from us there.
All right. That's pretty exciting stuff. It's a lot of, that's a whole crop of stuff. Now it's time for me to do my outro. Now we will be back next week for a wrap up podcast where we're going to talk about, like, you know, kind of our hopes for next season, our fears for next season, try to get to see if we can get an idea of how long we're gonna have to wait for next season. I'm going to dig into this showrunner interview and see if I can find something to howl with laughter or gnash my teeth at. You know, we are wrapping up the Rings of Power coverage. We'll be back, of course, next season, schedule permitting, life permitting, all that stuff. But it's our intention to come back. But if this is, you know, you're not quite convinced, you want to see where else the journey lies of Bald Move, please go to baldmove.com. That's our main website. You can follow our release schedule and what we do each and every day at twitter.com/baldmove. If you'd like to support us after all this, we'd appreciate it. support.baldmove.com. And as far as us, what we got coming up next, we're still putting the House of the Dragons to bed. We got another week or two of that left. We have 6 more weeks of The Walking Dead. Yeah, that's right. We're still a podcast covering it. It's been 11 years. No, 11 seasons, probably 13 plus years. We're going to end that. And then next year, we're looking forward to The Last of Us coming to HBO. We're looking forward to Foundation Season 2 returning to Apple TV. Looking forward to Severance. Looking forward to Yellow Jackets. Tons of different stuff that's coming back and new stuff too. Best way to follow along is twitter.com/baldmove. Dug2Deep at baldmove.com if you want to get some final thoughts in for the season wrap up. Until then, again, thanks to the Lorehounds for coming on to the show, and we'll see you next week.